paused. The psychological impulse behind just desserts is thoroughly intelligible. As Daly and Wilson observe, from the perspective of evolutionary psychology, this almost mystical and seemingly irreducible sort of moral imperative is the output of a mental mechanism with a straightforward adaptive function, to reckon justice and administer punishment by a calculus which ensures that violators reap no advantage from their misdeeds. The enormous volume of mystico-religious bafflegab about atonement and penance and divine justice and the like is the attribution to higher detached authority of what is actually a mundane pragmatic matter, discouraging self-interested competitive acts by reducing their profitability to nil. But since it is an irreducible imperative, whose evolutionary rationale is invisible to us when we are in the throes of it, the justice that people mete out in practice may be only loosely related to its incentive structure. The psychologists Kevin Carlsmith, John Darley, and Paul Robinson devised hypothetical cases designed to tease apart deterrence from just desserts. Just desserts is sensitive to the moral worth of the perpetrator's motive. For instance, an embezzler who used his ill-gotten gains to support a lavish lifestyle would seem to deserve a harsher punishment than one who redirected them to the company's underpaid workers in the developing world. Deterrence, in contrast, is sensitive to the incentive structure of the punishment regime. Assuming that malefactors reckon the utility of a misdeed as the probability that they will get caught, multiplied by the penalty they will incur if they do get caught, then a crime that is hard to detect should get a harsher punishment than one that is easy to detect. For similar reasons, a crime that gets a lot of publicity should be punished more harshly than one that is unpublicized, because the publicized one will leverage the value of the punishment as a general deterrent. When people are asked to mete out sentences to fictitious malefactors in these scenarios, their decisions are affected only by just deserts, not by deterrence. Evil motives draw harsher sentences, but difficult-to-detect or highly publicized infractions do not. The reforms advocated by the utilitarian economist Cesare Beccaria during the humanitarian revolution, which led to the abolition of cruel punishments, were designed to reorient criminal justice away from the raw impulse to make a bad person suffer and toward the practical goal of deterrence. The Carlsmith experiment suggests that people today have not gone all the way into thinking of criminal justice in purely utilitarian terms. But in the blank slate, I argue that even the elements of our judicial practices that seem to be motivated by just deserts may ultimately serve a deterrent function, because if a system ever became too narrowly utilitarian, malefactors would learn to game it. Just deserts can close off that option. Even the fairest system of criminal justice cannot monitor its citizens, wherever they may be, and around the clock. It has to count on them internalizing norms of fairness and dampening their vengeance before it escalates. In Chapter 3, we saw how the ranchers and farmers of Shasta County resolved their grievances without tattling to the police, thanks to reciprocity, gossip, occasional vandalism, and, for minor harms, lumping it. Why do the people in some societies lump it, while others experience a glow in their eyes, a flame in their cheeks, and a pounding in their temples? Norbert Elias's theory of the civilizing process suggests that government-administered justice can have knock-on effects that lead its citizens to internalize norms of self-restraint and quash their impulses for retribution rather than act on them. We saw many examples in Chapters 2 and 3 of how pacification by a government has a whopping effect on lethal vengeance. And in the next chapter, we will review experiments showing that self-control in one context can spread into others. Chapter 3 also introduced the finding that the sheer presence of government brings rates of violence down only so far, from the hundreds of homicides per 100,000 people per year to the tens. A further drop into the single digits may depend on something hazier, such as people's acceptance of the legitimacy of the government and social contract. A recent experiment may have caught a wisp of this phenomenon in the lab. The economists Benedict Herrmann, Christian Toni, and Simon Gottscher had university students in 16 countries play public goods games, the game in which players contribute money to a pot which is then doubled and redistributed among them, with and without the possibility of punishing one another. The researchers discovered, to their horror, that in some countries, many players punished generous contributions to the common good rather than stingy ones. These acts of spite had predictably terrible effects on the group's welfare, because they only reinforce every player's worst instinct to free ride on the contributions of others. The contributions soon petered out and everyone lost. The antisocial punishers seemed to have been motivated by an excess of revenge. When they themselves had been punished for a low contribution, rather than being chastened and increasing their contribution on the next round, which is what participants in the original studies conducted in the United States and Western Europe had done, they punished their punishers, who tended to be the altruistic contributors. What distinguishes the country in which the targets of punishment repent, such as the United States, Australia, China, and those of Western Europe, from those in which they spitefully retaliate, like Russia, Ukraine, Greece, Saudi Arabia, and Oman? The investigators ran a set of multiple regressions using a dozen traits of the different countries, taken from economic statistics and the results of international surveys. A major predictor of excess revenge turned out to be civic norms, a measure of the degree to which people think it is all right to cheat on their income taxes, claim government benefits to which they are not entitled, and dodge fare collectors on the subway. Social scientists believe that civic norms make up a large part of the social capital of a country, which is more important to its prosperity than its physical resources. Where might the civic norms themselves have come from? The World Bank assigns countries a score called the rule of law, which reflects how well private contracts can be enforced in courts, whether the legal system is perceived as being fair, the importance of the black market and organized crime, the quality of the police, and the likelihood of crime and violence. In the experiment, the rule of law of a country significantly predicted the degree to which its citizens indulged in antisocial revenge. The people in countries with an iffy rule of law were more destructively vengeful. With the usual spaghetti of variables, it's impossible to be certain what caused what, but the results are consistent with the idea that the disinterested justice of a decent Leviathan induces citizens to curb their impulses for revenge before it spirals into a destructive cycle. Revenge, for all its tendency to escalate, must come with a dimmer switch. If it didn't, the moralization gap would inflate every affront into an escalating feud, like the experimental subjects who mash down on each other's fingers harder and harder with every round. Not only does revenge not always escalate, especially in civil societies with the rule of law, but we shouldn't expect it to. The models of the evolution of cooperation showed that the most successful agents dial back their tit-for-tatting with contrition and forgiveness, especially when trapped in the same boat with other agents. In Beyond Revenge, The Evolution of the Forgiveness Instinct, the psychologist Michael McCullough shows that we do have this dimmer switch for revenge. As we have seen, several species of primate can kiss and make up after a fight, at least if their interests are bounded by kinship, shared goals, or common enemies. McCullough shows that the human forgiveness instinct is activated under similar circumstances. The desire for revenge is most easily modulated when the perpetrator falls within our natural circle of empathy. We are apt to forgive our kin and close friends for trespasses that would be unforgivable in others. And when our circle of empathy expands, a process we will examine in the next chapter, our circle of forgivability expands with it. A second circumstance that cranks down revenge is a relationship with the perpetrator that is too valuable to sever. We may not like them, but we're stuck with them, so we had better learn to live with them. During the presidential primary season, rivals for a party's nomination can spend months slinging each other with mud or worse, and their body language during televised debates makes it clear that they can't stand each other. But when the winner is decided, they bite their lips, swallow their pride, and unite against their common adversary in the other party. In many cases, the winner even invites the loser onto the ticket or into the cabinet. The power of a shared goal to induce erstwhile enemies to reconcile was dramatically demonstrated in a famous 1950s experiment, in which boys at a summer camp called Robber's Cave were divided into teams and on their own initiative waged war on each other for weeks, with raids and retaliations and dangerous weapons like rocks and socks. But when the psychologists arranged some accidents that left the boys no choice but to work together to restore the camp's water supply and to pull a bus out of the muck, they fell into a truce, overcame their enmity, and even made some friendships across team lines. The third modulator of revenge kicks in when we are assured that the perpetrator has become harmless. For all the warmth and fuzziness of forgiveness, you can't afford to disarm if the person who harmed you is likely to do it again. So if a harm-doer wants to avoid your wrath and get back on your good side, he has to persuade you that he no longer harbors any motive to harm you. He may start out by claiming that his harm was an unfortunate result of a unique set of circumstances that will never be repeated. That is, that the action was unintentional or unavoidable, or that the harm it did was unforeseen. Not coincidentally, these are the excuses that harm-doers believe about every harm they do, which is one side of the moralization gap. If that doesn't work, he can accept your side of the story by acknowledging that he did something wrong, sympathize with your suffering, cancel the harm with restitution, and commit his credibility to an assurance that he will not repeat it. In other words, he can apologize. All of these tactics, studies have shown, can mollify a rankled victim. The problem with an apology, of course, is that it can be cheap talk. An insincere apology can be more enraging than none at all, because it compounds the first harm with a second one, namely a cynical ploy to avert revenge. The aggrieved party needs to peer into the perpetrator's soul and see that any intention to harm again has been exercised. The devices that implement this born-again harmlessness are the self-conscious emotions of shame, guilt, and embarrassment. The problem for the perpetrator is how to make those emotions visible. As with all signaling problems, the way to make a signal credible is to make it costly. When a subordinate primate wants to appease a dominant one, he will make himself small, avert his gaze, and expose vulnerable body parts. The equivalent gestures in humans are called cringing, groveling, or bowing and scraping. We may also hand over control of the conspicuous parts of our bodies to our autonomic nervous system, the involuntary circuitry that controls blood flow, muscle tone, and the activity of the glands. An apology that is certified by blushing, stammering, and tears is more credible than one that is cool, calm, and collected. Crying and blushing are particularly affecting because they are felt from the inside as well as displayed on the outside, and hence generate common knowledge. The emoter knows that onlookers know his emotional state. The onlookers know he knows it, and so on. Common knowledge obliterates self-deception. The guilty party can no longer deny the uncomfortable truth. McCullough notes that our revenge modulators offer a route to public conflict reduction that can supplement the criminal justice system. The potential payoff can be enormous because the court system is expensive, inefficient, unresponsive to the victim's needs, and in its own way violent, since it forcibly incarcerates a guilty perpetrator. Many communities now have programs of restorative justice, sometimes supplementing a criminal trial, sometimes replacing it. The perpetrator and victim, often accompanied by family and friends, sit down together with a facilitator who gives the victim an opportunity to express his or her suffering and anger, and the perpetrator an opportunity to convey sincere remorse, together with restitution for the harm. It sounds like daytime TV, but it can set at least some repentant perpetrators on the straight and narrow, while satisfying their victims and keeping the whole dispute out of the slowly grinding wheels of the criminal justice system. On the international scene, the last two decades have seen an explosion of apologies by political leaders for crimes committed by their governments. The political scientist Graham Dodds has compiled a fairly comprehensive chronological listing of major political apologies through the centuries. His list begins in the year 1077, when Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV apologized to Pope Gregory VII for church-state conflicts by standing barefoot in the snow for 3 days. History had to wait more than 600 years for the next one, when Massachusetts apologized in 1711 to the families of the victims of the Salem witch trials. The first apology of the 20th century, Germany's admission to having started World War I in the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, is perhaps not the best advertisement for the genre, but the spate of apologies in the last two decades bespeak a new era in the self-presentation of states. For the first time in history, the leaders of nations have elevated the ideals of historical truth and international reconciliation above self-serving claims of national infallibility and rectitude. In 1984, Japan sort of apologized for occupying Korea when Emperor Hirohito told the visiting South Korean president, "It is regrettable that there was an unfortunate period in this century." But subsequent decades saw a string of ever more forthcoming apologies from other Japanese leaders. In the ensuing decades, Germany apologized for the Holocaust, the United States apologized for interning Japanese Americans, the Soviet Union apologized for murdering Polish prisoners during World War II, Britain apologized to the Irish, Indians, and Maori, and the Vatican apologized for its role in the wars of religion, the persecution of Jews, the slave trade, and the oppression of women. Political apologies are a sign of our times. Do apologies and other conciliatory gestures in the human social repertoire actually avert cycles of revenge? The political scientists William Long and Peter Breck took up the question in their 2003 book, War and Reconciliation: Reason and the Emotion in Conflict Resolution. Breck is the scholar who assembled the conflict catalog, which I relied upon in Chapter 5, and he and Long addressed the question with numbers. They selected 114 pairs of countries that fought an interstate war from 1888 to 1991, together with 430 civil wars. They then looked for reconciliation events, ceremonies or rituals that brought the leaders of the warring factions together, and compared the number of militarized disputes, incidents of saber-rattling or fighting, over several decades before and after the event to see if the rituals made any difference. They generated hypotheses and interpreted their findings using both rational actor theory and evolutionary psychology. When it came to international disputes, emotional gestures made little difference. Long and Breck identified 21 international reconciliation events and compared the ones that clearly cooled down the belligerents with the ones that left them as disputatious as ever. The successes depended not only on symbolic gestures, but on costly signaling. The leader of one or both countries made a novel, voluntary, risky, vulnerable, and irrevocable move toward peace that reassured his adversary that he was unlikely to resume hostilities. Anwar Sadat's 1977 speech to the Israeli parliament is the prototype. The gesture was a shocker, and it was unmistakably expensive, later costing Sadat his life. But it led to a peace treaty that has lasted to this day. There were few touchy-feely rituals, and today the two countries are hardly on good terms, but they are at peace. Long and Breck note that sometimes pairs of countries that looked daggers at each other for centuries can turn into good buddies. England and France, England and the United States, Germany and Poland, Germany and France. But the amity comes after decades of coexistence rather than as the immediate outcome of conciliatory gestures. The psychology of forgiveness, recall, works best when the perpetrator and victim are already bound by kinship, friendship, alliance, or mutual dependence. It is not surprising, then, that conciliatory gestures are more effective in ending wars than international ones. The adversaries in a civil war are, at the very least, stuck with each other inside national boundaries, and they have a flag and a soccer team that put them in a fictive coalition. Often the ties run deeper. They may share a language or religion, may work together, and may be related by webs of marriage. In many rebellions and warlord conflicts, the fighters may literally be sons, nephews, and neighborhood kids, and communities may have to welcome back the perpetrators of horrible atrocities against them if they are ever to knit their communities together. These and other ties that bind can prepare the way for gestures of apology and reconciliation. These gestures are more effective than the mechanism that leads to peace between states, namely the costly signaling of benevolent intentions, because in civil conflicts the two sides are not cleanly separated entities, and so cannot each speak with one voice, exchanging messages in safety, and resume the status quo if an initiative fails. Long and Breck studied 11 reconciliation events since 1957 that symbolically terminated a civil conflict. With 7 of them, 64%, there was no return to violence. That figure is impressive. Among conflicts that did not have a reconciliation event, only 9% saw a cessation of violence. The common denominator to the success stories they found was a set of conciliation rituals that implemented a symbolic and incomplete justice rather than perfect justice or none at all. Just as a microphone near a loudspeaker can amplify its own output and create an ear-splitting howl, retributive justice that visits new harm on the perpetrators can stoke the desire for retaliation in a spiral of competitive victimhood. Conversely, just as the feedback from a microphone can be squelched if the gain is turned down, cycles of communal violence can be squelched if the severity of retributive justice is modulated. A dampening of the desire for justice is particularly indispensable after civil conflicts, in which the institutions of justice, like the police and prison system, are not only fragile, but may themselves have been among the main perpetrators of the harm. The prototype for reconciliation after a civil conflict is South Africa. Invoking the Xhosa concept of Ubuntu, or brotherhood, Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu instituted a system of restorative rather than retributive justice to heal the country after decades of violent repression and rebellion under the apartheid regime. As with the tactics of the rights revolutions, Mandela and Tutu's restorative justice both sampled from and contributed to the pool of ideas for nonviolent conflict resolution. Similar programs, Long and Breck discovered, have cemented civil peace in Mozambique, Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, and El Salvador. They identify 4 ingredients of the successful elixir. The first is a round of uncompromised truth-telling and acknowledgement of harm. It may take the form of truth and reconciliation commissions, in which perpetrators publicly own up to the harms they did, or of national fact-finding committees, whose reports are widely publicized and officially endorsed. These mechanisms take direct aim at the self-serving psychology that stokes the moralization gap. Though truth-telling sheds no blood, it requires a painful emotional sacrifice on the part of the confessors in the form of shame, guilt, and a unilateral disarmament of their chief moral weapon, the claim to innocence. There is a vast psychological difference between a crime that everyone privately knows about but not everyone acknowledges, and one that is out there as common knowledge. Just as blushing and tears make an apology more effective, the public acknowledgement of a wrong can rewrite the rules of a relationship between groups. A second theme in successful reconciliations is an explicit rewriting of people's social identities. People redefine the groups with which they identify. The perpetual victims of a society may take responsibility for running it. Rebels become politicians, bureaucrats, or business people. The military surrenders its claim to embody the nation and demotes itself to their security guards. The third theme appears to be the most important, incomplete justice. Rather than settling every score, a society has to draw a line under past violations and grant massive amnesty while prosecuting only the blatant ringleaders and some of the more depraved foot soldiers. Even then, the punishments take the form of hits to their reputation, prestige and privileges rather than blood for blood. There may, in addition, be reparations, but their restorative value is registered more on an emotional balance sheet than a financial one. Long and Breck comment, "In every instance of successful reconciliation, save Mozambique, justice was meted out, but never in full measure. This fact may be lamentable, even tragic from certain legal or moral perspectives, yet it is consistent with the requisites of restoring social order postulated in the forgiveness hypothesis. In all cases of successful reconciliation, retributive justice could neither be ignored nor fully achieved. Disturbing as it may be, people appear to be able to tolerate a substantial amount of injustice wrought by amnesty in the name of social peace." In other words, peel off the bumper sticker that says, "If you want peace, work for justice." Replace it with the one recommended by Joshua Goldstein. "If you want peace, work for peace." Finally, the belligerents have to signal their commitment to a new relationship with a burst of verbal and nonverbal gestures. As Long and Breck observe, legislatures passed solemn resolutions, peace accords were signed and embraces exchanged by heads of formerly rival groups, statues and monuments to the tragedy were erected, textbooks were rewritten, and 1,000 other actions, large and small, were undertaken to underscore the notion that the past was different and the future more hopeful. The conflict between Israelis and Palestinians stands in many people's minds today as the nastiest ongoing cycle of deadly revenge. Not even Pollyanna would claim to have the key to solving it. But the applied psychology of reconciliation bears out the vision of the Israeli novelist Amos Oz on what a solution will have to look like. Tragedies can be resolved in one of two ways. There is the Shakespearean resolution, and there is the Chekhovian one. At the end of a Shakespearean tragedy, the stage is strewn with dead bodies, and maybe there's some justice hovering high above. A Chekhovian tragedy, on the other hand, ends with everybody disillusioned, embittered, heartbroken, disappointed, absolutely shattered, but still alive. And I want a Chekhovian resolution, not a Shakespearean one, for the Israeli-Palestinian tragedy. Sadism. It's hard to single out the most heinous form of human depravity. There are so many to choose from. But if genocide is the worst by quantity, sadism might be the worst by quality. The deliberate infliction of pain for no purpose but to enjoy a person's suffering is not just morally monstrous, but intellectually baffling. Because in exchange for the agony of the victim, the torturer receives no apparent personal or evolutionary benefit. And unlike many other sins, pure sadism is not a guilty pleasure that most people indulge in their fantasy lives. Few of us daydream about watching cats burn to death. Yet torture is a recurring disfigurement in human history and current events, appearing in at least five circumstances. Sadism can grow out of instrumental violence. The threat of torture can terrify political opponents, and it must at least occasionally be used to make the threat real. Torture may also be used to extract information from a criminal suspect or political enemy. Many police and national security forces engage in mild torture under euphemisms like the third degree, moderate physical pressure, and enhanced interrogation. And these tactics may sometimes be effective. And as moral philosophers since Jeremy Bentham have pointed out, in theory, torture can even be justifiable, most famously in the ticking bomb scenario in which a criminal knows the location of an explosive that will kill and maim many innocent people, and only torture would force him to disclose its location. Yet among the many arguments against the use of torture is that it seldom stays instrumental for long. Torturers get carried away. They inflict so much suffering on their victims that the victims will say anything to make it stop, or become so delirious with agony as to be incapable of responding. Often the victims die, which makes the extraction of information moot. And in cases like the abuse of Iraqi prisoners by American soldiers at Abu Ghraib, the use of torture, far from serving a useful purpose, was a strategic catastrophe for the country that allowed it to happen, inflaming enemies and alienating friends. A second occasion for torture is in criminal and religious punishment. Here again there is a granule of instrumental motivation, namely to deter wrongdoers with the prospect of pain that would cancel out their gain. Yet as Beccaria and other Enlightenment reformers pointed out, any calculus of deterrence can achieve the same goals with punishments that are less severe but more reliable. And surely the death penalty, if it is applied at all, is a sufficient disincentive to capital crimes without needing the then customary practice of preceding it with prolonged, gruesome torture. In practice, corporal punishment and excruciating capital punishment escalate into orgies of cruelty for its own sake. Entertainment itself can be a motive for torture, as at the Roman Colosseum and in blood sports like bear baiting and cat burning. Tuchman notes that towns in medieval France would sometimes purchase a condemned criminal from another town so they could entertain their citizens with a public execution. Hideous tortures and mutilations can accompany a rampage by soldiers, rioters, or militiamen, especially when they have been released from apprehension and fear, the phenomenon that Randall Collins calls forward panic. These are the atrocities that accompany pogroms, genocides, police brutality, and military routs, including those in tribal warfare. Finally, there are serial killers, the sickos who stalk, kidnap, torture, mutilate, and kill their victims for sexual gratification. Serial killers like Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and Jeffrey Dahmer are not the same as garden variety mass murderers. Mass murderers include men who run amok, like enraged postal workers who avenge a humiliation and prove their potency by taking as many people as they can with them in a final suicidal outburst. They also include spree killers like the Washington, D.C. sniper John Muhammad, who stretch out their vengeance and dominance over several weeks. With serial killers, in contrast, the motive is sadism. They are aroused by the prospect of tormenting, disfiguring, dismembering, eviscerating, and slowly draining the life out of victims with their bare hands. Even the most jaded consumer of human atrocities will find something to shock them in Harold Schechter's authoritative compendium, The Serial Killer Files. For all its notoriety and rock songs made for TV movies and Hollywood blockbusters, serial killing is a rare phenomenon. The criminologists James Allen Fox and Jack Levin note that there may actually be more scholars studying serial murder than there are offenders committing it. And even that small number, like every other tabulation of violence we have examined in this book, has been in decline. In the 1980s, when serial killers were a pop sensation, there were 200 known perpetrators in all, and they killed around 70 victims a year. In the 1990s, there were 141, and in the 2000s, only 61. Those figures may be underestimates, because many serial killers prey on runaways, prostitutes, the homeless, and others whose disappearance may not have been reported as murders. But by any reckoning, no more than 2 or 3 dozen serial killers can be at large in the United States at any time, and they are collectively responsible for a tiny fraction of the 17,000 homicides that take place every year. Serial killing is nothing new. Schechter shows that contrary to a common view that serial killers are the product of our sick society, they have splattered the pages of history for millennia. Caligula, Nero, Bluebeard, probably based on the 15th century knight Gilles de Rais, Vlad the Impaler, and Jack the Ripper are celebrity examples, and scholars have speculated that legends of werewolves, robber bridegrooms, and demon barbers may have been based on widely retold tales of actual serial killers. All that is new in sadistic killing is the name for the motive, which comes to us courtesy of the most famous serial torturer of all, Donatien Alphonse François, also known as the Marquis de Sade. In earlier centuries, serial killers were called murder fiends, bloodthirsty monsters, devils in human shape, or the morally insane. Though the florid sadism of serial killers is historically rare, the sadism of inquisitors, rampagers, public execution spectators, blood sport fans, and Colosseum audiences is not. And even serial killers don't end up with their avocation because of any gene, brain lesion, or childhood experience we can identify. They do tend to be victims of childhood sexual and physical abuse, but so are millions of people who don't grow up to be serial killers. So it's conceivable that the pathway to serial killing can shed light on the pathway that leads ordinary people into sadism as well. How can we make sense of this most senseless variety of violence? The development of sadism requires two things: motives to enjoy the suffering of others, and a removal of the restraints that ordinarily inhibit people from acting on them. Though it's painful to admit, human nature comes equipped with at least four motives to take satisfaction in the pain of others. One is a morbid fascination with the vulnerability of living things, a phenomenon perhaps best captured by the word macabre. This is what leads boys to pull the legs off grasshoppers and to fry ants with a magnifying glass. It leads adults to rubberneck at the scene of automobile accidents, a vice that can tie up traffic for miles, and to fork over their disposable income to read and watch gory entertainment. The ultimate motive may be mastery over the living world, including our own safety. The implicit lesson of macabre voyeurism may be, but for the swerve of a steering wheel or an unlocked front door, that could have happened to me. Another appeal of feeling someone's pain is dominance. It can be enjoyable to see how the mighty have fallen, especially if they have been among your tormentors. And when one is looking downward instead of upward, it's reassuring to know that you can exercise the power to dominate others should the need arise. The ultimate form of power over someone is the power to cause them pain at will. Nowadays, neuroscientists will slide people into a magnet to look at just about any human experience. Though no one, to my knowledge, has studied sadism in the scanner, a recent experiment looked at the diluted version, Schadenfreude. Male Japanese students lay in an MRI machine and were asked to put themselves in the shoes of a schlemiel who longs for a job in a multinational information technology company but earns mediocre grades, flubs his job interview, warms the bench in his baseball club, ends up with a low-paying job in a retail store, lives in a tiny apartment, and has no girlfriend. At his college reunion, he meets a classmate who works for a multinational corporation, lives in a luxury condo, owns a fancy car, dines at French restaurants, collects watches, jet sets to weekend vacation spots, and has many opportunities to meet girls after work. The participant also imagines meeting two other classmates, one successful, one unsuccessful, whom the Japanese researchers assumed, correctly as it turned out, would arouse no envy in the participant because they were women. The participant, still imagining himself the loser, then reads about a string of misfortunes that befall his envied but increasingly Job-like classmate. The classmate is falsely accused of cheating on an exam. He becomes the victim of ugly rumors. His girlfriend has an affair, his company gets into financial trouble, his bonus is small, his car breaks down, his watches are stolen, his apartment building is sprayed with graffiti, he gets food poisoning at the French restaurant, and his vacation is canceled because of a typhoon. The researchers could literally read the gloating off the participants' brains. As the participants read of the misfortunes of their virtual better, though not of the non-threatening women, their striatum, the part of the seeking circuit that underlies wanting and liking, lit up like a Tokyo boulevard. The results were the same when women contemplated the downfall of an enviable female rival. A third occasion for sadism is revenge, or the sanitized third-party version we call justice. The whole point of moralistic punishment is that the wrongdoer suffers for his sins, and we have already seen that revenge can be sweet. Revenge literally turns off the empathic response in the brain, at least among men, and is consummated only when the avenger knows that the target knows that his suffering is payback for his misdeeds. What better way for the avenger to be certain in that knowledge than to inflict the suffering himself? Finally, there is sexual sadism. Sadism itself is not a common perversion. Among people who indulge in S&M, far more of them are into the M than the S. But milder forms of domination and degradation are not uncommon in pornography, and they may be a byproduct of the fact that males are the more ardent and females the more discriminating gender. The circuits for sexuality and aggression are intertwined in the limbic system, and both respond to testosterone. Male aggression has a sexual component. In interviews, many soldiers describe battlefield routes in explicitly erotic terms. One Vietnam veteran said, "To some people, carrying a gun was like having a permanent hard-on. It was a pure sexual trip every time you got to pull the trigger." Another agreed, "There is just this incredible sense of power in killing five people. The only way I can equate it is to ejaculation. Just an incredible sense of relief, you know, that I did this." Institutionalized torture is often sexualized as well. Female Christian martyrs were depicted as having been sexually mutilated, and when the tables were turned in medieval Christendom, the instruments of torture were often directed at women's erogenous zones. As with the martyrologies, later genre of macabre entertainment such as pulp fiction, Grand Guignol, and true crime tabloids often put female protagonists in peril of sexual torture and mutilation. And government torturers in police states have often been reported to be aroused by their atrocities. Lloyd DeMause recounts testimony from a survivor of the Holocaust. The SS camp commander stood close to the whipping post throughout the flogging. His whole face was already red with lascivious excitement. His hands were plunged deep in his trouser pockets, and it was quite clear that he was masturbating throughout. On more than 30 occasions, I myself have witnessed SS camp commanders masturbating during floggings. If serial killers represent the taste for rough sex taken to an extreme, the gender difference among serial killers who come in both sexes is instructive. Schechter is skeptical of self-anointed profilers and mindhunters like the Jack Crawford character in Silence of the Lambs, but he allows for one kind of inference from the modus operandi of a serial killer to a characteristic trait. When police discover a corpse with its throat slit, its torso cut open, its viscera removed, and its genitals excised, they are justified in making one basic assumption. The perpetrator was a man. It's not that girls can never grow up to be serial killers. Schechter recounts the stories of several black widows and angels of death, but they go about their pastimes differently. Schechter explains, "There are unmistakable parallels between male serial killers' kinds of violence, phallic aggressive, penetrative, rapacious, and, insofar as it commonly gratifies itself upon the bodies of strangers, undiscriminating, and the typical pattern of male sexual behavior. For this reason, it is possible to see sadistic mutilation murder as a grotesque distortion of normal male sexuality. Female psychopaths are no less depraved than their male counterparts. As a rule, however, brutal penetration is not what turns them on. Their excitement comes not from violating the bodies of strangers with phallic objects, but from a grotesque, sadistic travesty of intimacy and love, from spooning poisoned medicine into the mouth of a trusting patient, for example, or smothering a sleeping child in its bed. In short, from tenderly turning a friend, family member, or dependent into a corpse, from nurturing them to death." With so many sources for sadism, why are there so few sadists? Obviously, the mind must be equipped with safety catches against hurting others, and sadism erupts when they are disabled. The first that comes to mind is empathy. If people feel each other's pain, then hurting someone else will be felt as hurting oneself. That is why sadism is more thinkable when the victims are demonized or dehumanized beings that lie outside one's circle of empathy. But as I have mentioned, and as we shall explore in the next chapter, for empathy to be a brake on aggression, it has to be more than the habit of inhabiting another person's mind. After all, sadists often exercise a perverted ingenuity for intuiting how best to torment their victims. An empathic response must specifically include an alignment of one's own happiness with that of another being, a faculty that is better called sympathy or compassion than empathy. Baumeister points out that an additional emotion has to kick in for sympathy to inhibit behavior. guilt. Guilt, he notes, does not just operate after the fact. Much of our guilt is anticipatory. We refrain from actions that would make us feel bad if we carried them out. Another break on sadism is a cultural taboo, the conviction that deliberate infliction of pain is not a thinkable option, regardless of whether it engages one's sympathetic inhibitions. Today, torture has been explicitly prohibited by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and by the 1949 Geneva Conventions. Unlike ancient, medieval, and early modern times, when torture was a form of popular entertainment, today the infliction of torture by governments is almost entirely clandestine, showing that the taboo is widely acknowledged, although like most taboos, it is at times hypocritically flouted. In 2001, the legal scholar Alan Dershowitz addressed this hypocrisy by proposing a legal mechanism designed to eliminate sub rosa torture in democracies. The police in a ticking bomb scenario would have to get a warrant from a disinterested judge before torturing the life-saving information out of a suspect. All other forms of coercive interrogation would be flatly prohibited. The most common response was outrage. By the very act of examining the taboo on torture, Dershowitz had violated the taboo, and he was widely misunderstood as advocating torture rather than seeking to minimize it. Some of the more measured critics argued that the taboo in fact serves a useful function. Better, they said, to deal with a ticking bomb scenario, should one ever occur, on an ad hoc basis, and perhaps even put up with some clandestine torture than to place torture on the table as a live option from which it could swell from ticking bombs to a wider range of real or imagined threats. But perhaps the most powerful inhibition against sadism is more elemental, a visceral revulsion against hurting another person. Most primates find the screams of pain of a fellow animal to be aversive, and they will abstain from food if it is accompanied by the sound and sight of a fellow primate being shocked. The distress is an expression not of the monkey's moral scruples, but of its dread of making a fellow animal mad as hell. It also may be a response to whatever external threat would have caused a fellow animal to issue an alarm call. The participants in Stanley Milgram's famous experiment, who obeyed instructions to deliver shocks to a bogus fellow participant, were visibly distraught as they heard the shrieks of pain they were inflicting. Even in moral philosophers' hypothetical scenarios like the trolley problem, survey takers recoil from the thought of throwing the fat man in front of the trolley, though they know it would save 5 innocent lives. Testimony on the commission of hands-on violence in the real world is consistent with the results of laboratory studies. As we saw, humans don't readily consummate mano-a-mano fisticuffs, and soldiers on the battlefield may be petrified about pulling the trigger. The historian Christopher Browning's interviews with Nazi reservists who were ordered to shoot Jews at close range showed that their initial reaction was a physical revulsion to what they were doing. The reservists did not recollect the trauma of their first murders in the morally colored ways we might expect, neither with guilt at what they were doing, nor with retroactive excuses to mitigate their culpability. Instead, they recalled how viscerally upset they were made by the screams, the gore, and the raw feeling of killing people at close range. As Baumeister sums up their testimony, the first day of mass murder did not prompt them to engage in spiritual soul-searching so much as it made them literally want to vomit. There are barriers to sadism, then, but there must also be workarounds, or sadism would not exist. The crudest workaround is evident during rampages, when a window of opportunity to rout the enemy opens up and any revulsion against hands-on harm is suspended. The most sophisticated workaround may be the willing suspension of disbelief that allows us to immerse ourselves in fictional worlds. One part of the brain allows us to lose ourselves in the story and perhaps indulge in a touch of virtual sadism. The other reminds us that it's all make-believe, so our inhibitions don't spoil the pleasure. Psychopathy is a lifelong disabling of the inhibitions against sadism. Psychopaths have a blunted response in their amygdala and orbital cortex to signs of distress, together with a marked lack of sympathy with the interests of other people. All serial killers are psychopaths, and survivors of brutal government interrogation and punishment often report that some of the guards stood out from others in their sadism, presumably the psychopaths. Yet most psychopaths are not serial killers or even sadists, and in some environments, such as public spectacles of cruelty in medieval Europe, nearly everyone indulged in sadism. That means we need to identify the pathway that leads people, some more easily than others, toward the infliction of pain for pleasure. Sadism is literally an acquired taste. Government torturers, such as police interrogators and prison guards, follow a counterintuitive career trajectory. It's not the rookies who are overly exuberant and the veterans who fine-tune the pain to extract the maximum amount of actionable information. Instead, it's the veterans who torture prisoners beyond any conceivable purpose. They come to enjoy their work. Other forms of sadism also must be cultivated. Most sexual sadists start out wielding the whips and collars as a favor to the numerous masochists. Only gradually do they start to enjoy it. Serial killers, too, carry out their first murder with trepidation, distaste, and, in its wake, disappointment. The experience had not been as arousing as it had been in their imaginations. But as time passes and their appetite is re-whetted, they find the next one easier and more gratifying, and then they escalate the cruelty to feed what turns into an addiction. One can imagine that when tortures and executions are public and common, as in the European Middle Ages, the acclimatization process can inure an entire population. It's often said that people can become desensitized to violence, but that is not what happens when people acquire a taste for torture. They are not oblivious to the suffering of others in the way that the neighbors of a fish processing plant stop noticing the noisome smell. Sadists take pleasure in the suffering of victims, or in the case of serial killers, positively crave it. Baumeister explains the acquisition of sadism with the help of a theory of motivation proposed by the psychologist Richard Solomon, based on an analogy with color vision. Emotions come in pairs, Solomon suggested, like complementary colors. The world as seen through rose-tinted goggles eventually returns to neutral. But when the goggles are removed, it looks greenish for a while. That is because our sense of neutral white or gray reflects the present status of a tug-of-war between circuits for the color red, more accurately, longer wavelengths, and circuits for the color green, medium wavelengths. When red-sensitive neurons are overactivated for a protracted period, they habituate and relax their tug, and the rosy tint in our consciousness fades out. Then when the goggles are removed, the red and green-sensitive neurons are equally stimulated. But the red ones have been desensitized while the green ones are ready and rested. So the green side predominates in the tug of war, and greenness is what we experience. Solomon suggested that our emotional state, like our perception of the color of the world, is kept in equilibrium by a balance of opposing circuits. Fear is in balance with reassurance, euphoria with depression, hunger with satiety. The main difference between opposing emotions and complementary colors is in how they change with experience. With the emotions, a person's initial reaction gets weaker over time, and the balancing impulse gets stronger. As an experience is repeated, the emotional rebound is more keenly felt than the emotion itself. The first leap in a bungee jump is terrifying, and the sudden yawing of deceleration, exhilarating, followed by an interlude of tranquil euphoria. But with repeated jumps, the reassurance component strengthens, which makes the fear subside more quickly and the pleasure arrive earlier. If the most concentrated moment of pleasure is the sudden reversal of panic by reassurance, then the weakening of the panic response over time may require the jumper to try increasingly dangerous jumps to get the same degree of acceleration. The action-reaction dynamic may be seen with positive initial experiences as well. The first hit of heroin is euphoric and the withdrawal mild. But as the person turns into a junkie, the pleasure lessens, and the withdrawal symptoms come earlier and are more unpleasant until the compulsion is less to attain the euphoria than to avoid the withdrawal. According to Baumeister, sadism follows a similar trajectory. An aggressor experiences a revulsion to hurting his victim, but the discomfort cannot last forever, and eventually, a reassuring, energizing counter-emotion resets his equilibrium to neutral. With repeated bouts of brutality, the re-energizing process gets stronger and turns off the revulsion earlier. Eventually, it predominates and tilts the entire process toward enjoyment, exhilaration, and then craving. As Baumeister puts it, the pleasure is in the backwash. By itself, the opponent process theory is a bit too crude, predicting, for example, that people would hit themselves over the head because it feels so good when they stop. Clearly, not all experiences are governed by the same tension between reaction and counter-reaction, nor by the same gradual weakening of the first and strengthening of the second. There must be a subset of aversive experiences that especially lend themselves to being overcome. The psychologist Paul Rosen has identified a syndrome of acquired tastes he calls benign masochism. These paradoxical pleasures include consuming hot chili peppers, strong cheese, and dry wine, and partaking in extreme experiences like saunas, skydiving, car racing, and rock climbing. All of them are adult tastes in which a neophyte must overcome a first reaction of pain, disgust, or fear on the way to becoming a connoisseur. And all are acquired by controlling one's exposure to the stressor in gradually increasing doses. What they have in common is a coupling of high potential gains, nutrition, medicinal benefits, speed, knowledge of new environments, with high potential dangers, poisoning, exposure, accidents. The pleasure in acquiring one of these tastes is the pleasure of pushing the outside of the envelope, of probing in calibrated steps how high, hot, strong, fast, or far one can go without bringing on disaster. The ultimate advantage is to open up beneficial regions in the space of local experiences that are closed off by default by innate fears and cautions. Benign masochism is an overshooting of this motive of mastery, and as Solomon and Baumeister point out, the revulsion-overcoming process can overshoot so far as to result in craving and addiction. In the case of sadism, the potential benefits are dominance, revenge, and sexual access, and the potential dangers are reprisals from the victim or victim's allies. Sadists do become connoisseurs. The instruments of torture in medieval Europe, police interrogation centers, and the lairs of serial killers can be gruesomely sophisticated. And sometimes, they can become addicts. The fact that sadism is an acquired taste is both frightening and hopeful. As a pathway prepared by the motivational systems of the brain, sadism is an ever-present danger to individuals, security forces, or subcultures who take the first step and can proceed to greater depravity in secrecy. Yet it does have to be acquired, and if those first steps are blocked and the rest of the pathway bathed in sunlight, the path to sadism can be foreclosed. Ideology. Individual people have no shortage of selfish motives for violence, but the really big body counts in history pile up when a large number of people carry out a motive that transcends any one of them, an ideology. Like predatory or instrumental violence, ideological violence is a means to an end. But with an ideology, the end is idealistic, a conception of the greater good. Yet for all that idealism, it's ideology that drove many of the worst things that people have ever done to each other. They include the Crusades, the European Wars of Religion, the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, the Russian and Chinese Civil Wars, the Vietnam War, the Holocaust, and the genocides of Stalin, Mao, and Pol Pot. An ideology can be dangerous for several reasons. The infinite good it promises prevents its true believers from cutting a deal. It allows any number of eggs to be broken to make the utopian omelet, and it renders opponents of the ideology infinitely evil, and hence deserving of infinite punishment. We have already seen the psychological ingredients of a murderous ideology. The cognitive prerequisite is our ability to think through long chains of means-ends reasoning, which encourage us to carry out unpleasant means as a way to bring about desirable ends. After all, in some spheres of life, the ends really do justify the means. such as the bitter drugs and painful procedures we undergo as part of a medical treatment. Means-ends reasoning becomes dangerous when the means to a glorious end include harming human beings.